You're listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Good evening, and welcome to the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. On behalf of the Library Foundation and the Los Angeles Public Library, thank you for coming out. My name is Justin Veach. I'm the Director of New Initiatives for the Library Foundation. This evening's program, Create Dangerously, like quote, unquote, like the quote from the book, Create Dangerously for People Who Read Dangerously. This is what I've always thought it meant to be a writer. Writing, knowing in part that no matter how trivial your words may seem, someday, somewhere, someone may risk his or her life to read them. So writes our guest this evening, the celebrated Haitian-American author Edwige Dantica, in her newest book of essays, Create Dangerously, a reflection on art and exile and an examination of what it means to be an immigrant artist from a country in crisis. Inspired by Albert Camus' lecture, Create Dangerously, and combining memoir and essay, Dantica tells the stories of artists, including herself, who create despite or because of the horrors that drove them from their homelands and that continue to haunt them. Dantica eulogizes an aunt who guarded her family's homestead in the Haitian countryside, a cousin who died of AIDS while living in Miami as an undocumented alien, and a renowned Haitian radio journalist whose political assassination shocked the world. Dantica writes about the Haitian novelist she first read as a girl at the Brooklyn Public Library, a woman mutilated in a machete attack, and the work of Jean-Michel Basquiat and other artists of Haitian descent. Dantica also demonstrates the parallels, as you'll see, and the similarities between the two countries in terms of their history, and suggests that the aftermaths of natural disasters in Haiti and the U.S. reveal that the countries are not as different as many Americans might like to believe. Edwige was born in Haiti in 1969, moved to the United States when she was 12, and is the acclaimed author of 6 books and 2 collections of stories. Her nonfiction book, Brother, I'm Dying, was a finalist for the National Book Award and winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award for Autobiography. She is a 2009 recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship. In conversation this evening with Edwige is one of our Aloud favorites and stalwarts, Amy Wilentz. She is the author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, Martyrs Crossing, and I Feel Earthquakes More Often Than They Happen, Coming to California in the Age of Schwarzenegger. Amy is the winner of the Whiting Writers Award and Penn Martha Albrand Nonfiction Award and the American Academy of Arts and Letters Rosenthal Award, and also a 1990 nominee for the National Book Critics Circle Award. She is the former Jerusalem correspondent of The New Yorker and a longtime contributing editor at The Nation. She teaches in the literary journalism program at the University of California, Irvine, and is married to another friend of Aloud and to the library as well, Nick Goldberg. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Amy Wilentz and Edwige Dantica to the Los Angeles Central Library.
Good evening. It's a pleasure for me to be here tonight, especially with Amy Wilentz. I will drool over her a little bit more in a minute. I will start with a reading, and I'll read a shortened version of an even shorter essay in the book called The Other Side of the Water. And it's about a cousin of mine who died in Miami. In the summer of 1997, I flew to Port-au-Prince from New York a few days after my cousin Marius had flown in the cargo section of a similar American Airlines jet from Miami. Once I'd slept past the first half hour after takeoff, I'd strapped on the free headphones and chosen from the in-flight radio selection a pop station playing a song by the rock group Midnight Oil. Across the aisle from me, a man in a wrinkled brown suit shuffled a few papers in and out of a large manila envelope onto the tray table in front of him. He wiped his brow with a blue handkerchief, then rang the flight attendant call button. When a plump blonde woman hurried over, he asked her for a glass of water. When she brought it to him, he asked her when we were going to land. I recognized the man who had been escorted by immigration officers past the security checkpoint, right down through the gate and onto his seat on the airplane. He was a deportee. While looking at him, I thought of my cousin, Marius, who in his own way had also been deported. I had foreseen the two of us, Marius and me, traveling on the same day, and my New York flight arriving a few hours before his Miami one, so that I could be there to greet him at the airport in Port-au-Prince. But the obstacles to Marius's flight had been abruptly lifted, and he had gone ahead on his own before me to be buried. Originally, Marius's departure had been delayed because the undertaker could not locate his papers. Before his mother called us from New York from Haiti to announce his death to my father and to ask for our help in getting the body sent to her from Miami, I hadn't seen or spoken to Marius in years. Only 2 years younger than he was, I had barely interacted with him when I was a girl because his parents had divorced when I was quite young and he lived mostly with his father. My father could barely remember Marius at all, as he was still a boy when Papa left Haiti for the United States. A decade after I'd moved to the United States, I heard that Marius had taken a boat to Miami. A few days before my flight from New York to Port-au-Prince, his mother had called to tell us that he was dead. Once he had offered his condolences to Tanzi over the phone, my father asked me to pick up the extension and tell my aunt that I would take care of things, that I would get Marius's body sent back to Haiti. After offering my own condolences to Tanzi, I asked her where Marius was living before he died. She paused as if to breathe past a large lump in her throat, then whispered, "Miami," sounding puzzled as if wondering why I was making her repeat something she'd already repeated many times. "Do you have the address of the place where he was living in Miami?" I asked. "No," she said, but she did have the telephone number of Marius' roommate of 2 years. His name was Delence. I dialed Delence's number soon after I hung up with Tanzi and asked in Creole if I could speak with him. The young man who answered replied, "Would you mind speaking English? I grew up here. It's hard for me to speak Creole." It turned out that that was Delence. I told him, in English, that I was Marius's cousin and was trying to help locate his body to send it back to Port-au-Prince. He gave me the number of the Freeman Funeral Home where Marius's body had already been placed while awaiting expatriation. At the end of the conversation, I cautiously asked Delence in my most polite voice, "Can you please tell me what Marius died of?" "Mauvais maladie," the bad disease, he said in perfectly non-accented Creole. He died of the bad disease, a euphemism for AIDS. "When did it happen?" I asked. "When did he get it?" "I don't know." He switched back to hip-hop-toned English. "Maybe he had it even before he left Haiti. I don't know, but he's been living wild here, man. He made some stupid-ass mistakes." "Did he leave anything behind?" I thought that my aunt might want to know. Maybe Marius had some assets that could help mitigate the transportation and funeral cost. But I wasn't thinking only about money. Perhaps there were more personal effects, legal papers, letters, photographs, journals, keepsakes that later on might comfort his mother. "He had nothing," Delence replied harshly. "He was living it up and wasted everything. All he had when he died was $60. The funeral, if held in Miami, would cost $3,000, Mr. Freeman told me when I called. But for Marius's body to be shipped to Haiti, the price would go up to $5,000. But first, he said, Mr. Freeman, we would need papers. What kind of papers? I asked. Because Marius had come to Miami by boat and had never received asylum or legalized his status some other way, he was undocumented. I have to get him exit papers from the Haitian consulate, explained Mr. Freeman. The U.S. authorities will want to see these papers at the airport before he leaves, and the Haitian authorities will want to see them when he arrives. He is a dead man whose cadaver needs to be shipped back to the country where he was born, I said. Why is it so complicated? In part, he answered calmly, because he was an alien. The next day, I called Tanzi and explained all that I had heard about Marius' return to Haiti. Tanzi was aware of the funeral cost, she said. She just wanted to confirm that De Lenz was telling the truth. Marius should be home soon, my father told her. Before she hung up, Tanzi began sobbing again. My father interrupted her and told her to calm down, to make sure she had her head on straight so she could face what lay ahead. You haven't seen your son in years, he reminded her. He's coming back to you in a coffin. Mit femme su, be the strong woman that you have to be. You're right, my brother, she said, still sniffling in my ear on the other extension. I'll have to put myself together to face this. I'm sorry I can't come be with you, my father, who was recovering from very early symptoms of the pulmonary fibrosis that would eventually kill him, said to Tanzi. M'comprenne, frère, she said. I understand, my brother. 3 days later, Marius' exit papers came in. After 8 days in Mr. Freeman's morgue, Marius was going home. In the meantime, my father had a sudden crisis with his health, and I missed Marius' departure day. Marius' body was shipped to Port-au-Prince. I couldn't find another seat on another flight, so I missed his arrival in Port-au-Prince and his wake and burial, too. I saw Tanzi several times that summer in Haiti, once at the baptism of her newest granddaughter, the child of her only daughter, Marie. She also came to visit me at the seaside campus where I was working, helping to teach a college course to American students. One afternoon when she came to visit, we sat on the warm sand under an almond tree as two of my Haitian cousins played soccer and water volleyball with some of the students in the course. We watched the calm turquoise sea and bare brown mountains in the distance, the clouds shifting ever so carefully above them, rationing sunshine and shade. I knew that Marius would come up at some point that afternoon, and he did. I know this is what you do now, Tanzi said, this thing with the writing. I know this is your work, but please don't write what you think you know about Marius. The truth is that I knew very little about Marius. Even though we were cousins, the same blood, our adult lives, my adult life, his adult death, might have never intersected at all had I not been asked to return his body home. In the end, there had been very little drama, even in this returning of the body home. It was all so sanitized, so over the phone. This type of thing happened all the time, Mr. Freeman and De Lenz had each explained to me in its own way. Family members realize that they are discovering or recovering in death fragments of a life that had swirled in secrets. In Haiti, the same expression, l'autre bord de l'eau, the other side of the water, can be used to denote the eternal afterlife as well as an emigre's eventual destination. It is sometimes impossible, even for those of us who are on the same side of l'autre bord de l'eau, to truly know one another. People talk, Tanzi went on. They say that everything they say to you ends up written down somewhere. And because she was my elder, my beloved aunt, I bowed my head in shame, wishing I could apologize for that too. But the immigrant artist, like all other artists, is a leech, and I needed to latch on. I wanted to quote the French poet and critique Stéphane Mallarmé and tell her that of course everything in the world exists to end up in a book. I wanted to ask her forgiveness for the essay that in my mind, even sitting there next to her, I was already writing. The most I could do, however, was to promise her that I would not use her real name or Marius's name. She was silent again, momentarily comforted by that tiny compromise. I changed the subject, asking if she wanted to go swimming. Just to relax her body a little, I said, before the return trip back from the resort village where I was teaching. I thought she would say no. She had turned me down before. Still, I hoped that she might surprise me and say yes. Mbakapab, she began, I can't, then corrected herself, Mbavli, I don't want to. A large cloud lingered above, casting a hint of gray above us, but it was still sunny above the water, the waves glittering as though tinting the fogginess above. Some people do come back from the other side of the water, don't they? She said, her eyes fixed on the same water. You are proof of that, no? She raised her hands high in the air, aiming them at the twinkling sea, as if to both scold and embrace it. They do, I said. But then, why didn't Marius come back? She seemed to be asking both me and the sea. Bakwane, I said, I don't know. It's stupid to even ask, she said, scratching the short gray hair under the white kerchief that covered her head. How could any of us know the answer to something like that? Only the sea and God know, right? I suppose I should be glad we didn't lose him at sea, she said. With her eyes still on the water, she got up and peeled off her milky white clothes, and wearing only her bra and panties, she walked towards the ocean as if for an ordinary afternoon swim. Thank you.
So you've proven to everyone here, Edwige, that you are indeed a betrayer, someone willing to rat out your own family.
A traitor.
You know, we all like to say, writers who write nonfiction especially, and Edwige writes both fiction and nonfiction, but we like to say that we are doing something more important, and we're telling truths that have to be told, and that, you know, so we, in honor of our beloved aunt, we disguise her name, but we still feel compelled to tell those stories. And, you know, the title of Edwige's book is Creating Dangerously. And I think that she sees that in many different lights, in a personal light, in a political light. And I wondered if you would just talk about that for a little bit.
Okay.
Create Dangerously.
Create Dangerously.
It's a command.
Hey, that's fine. Well, first of all, it's very nice to be here with you and with all of you, but especially with you, because I think you sort of created a path and sort of for a lot of us, both Haitians and non-Haitians, who write
it's
about
so awful
Haiti.
To be an elder statesman.
No, in terms of sort of long nonfiction that looks very closely at Haiti in a very complex and nuanced way. So I thank you for that. And you created Dangerously yourself. Actually, the title of the book comes from a lecture by Albert Camus called Create Dangerously. And it's something I love. I love Camus, and I just, the novels are great, but he also has written some extraordinary essays, some about his childhood and the political essays, but the personal ones are very beautiful. And this one is... The Create Dangerously is an essay about art and political engagement, but also the freedom to create. And the essay starts with saying that all we, you know, artists pray, you know, crave interesting times. But then faced with interesting times, you often have the dilemma that if you speak to them, like if you speak politically, that sometimes you can't win in a way we're talking
right.
about. That if you're too political, you're criticized. If you're silent, you're criticized. And trying to find that space in between where you're true to your art, but also you're true to your conviction. So that's where that came from. But I see also Create Dangerously. There's a metaphorical way of creating dangerously. I think all creation, all kind of art, involves some level of risk, personal risk.
You might embarrass yourself.
Exactly, or you might lose your family. People may never speak to you again. But then also there's this, in the history of Haiti, also these other artists who've created at great risk to their lives. So it sort of examines both of that element of creation.
Right, and in Haiti, over the years, one of the problems has been is that any speech, any truth could be punished severely. So, and you talk in the book about Numa and Drouin, Marcel Numa and Louis Drouin, and this is kind of, in this book, Edwige sort of uses their story as what I take to be her creation myth, the creation myth that has made this incredible writer. And I wondered if you could address that, both talk about the execution, how it came about, and then your kind of emotion about it.
Well, this was the last sort of state-sponsored public execution in Haiti. It was two young men who were from Jérémy. We called, Jérémy is the city of poets because there are so many poets from Jérémy. And there was right before, when they were young, this great massacre in Jérémy.
By François Duvalier, Papa Doc. Yeah.
And these young men, among others, had survived it, and they moved to the U.S. And they started this thing in Queens. They had, it was part of it was like this Bay of Pigs thing, and they had actually conflicts among themselves.
It was like Haiti's Bay of Pigs.
Yeah, exactly. And some of them were very conflicted about sort of, you know, the U.S. government part, because also the
unspoken thing is that these guys created in Brooklyn, was it?
In Queens.
A group called Jeune Haïti, and it was CIA-sponsored. It wasn't maybe CIA originally, but they saw it, and they came in and wanted to use these guys.
Yeah. And they had, you know, even among the guys, they were very conflicted about, you know, they were training in the Dominican Republic. But ultimately, all but these two, Numa and Duin, survived, and they were executed. And part of the interest, it was something that even people who weren't there in my family would talk about, and I would always hear about this story. But for my uncle, especially where I grew up in that neighborhood, which was close to the cemetery, their thing was that they felt like it was after that execution, in a way, things
they
changed.
Were killed in the cemetery,
in the
correct?
Cemetery, yeah. And school children were brought in, and you know, it was made, and there were photographs all over town days after that, and then it was such a signal to people that it's sort of like people change the way they, you know, a lot of things change as the way my uncle did. And one of the things that changed was also the way writers started creating their art. And a lot of the playwrights then started shifting also the way they talked about the dictatorship in terms of public art. So they did, you know, they read and performed if
they
were doing a lot of foreign artists.
They became braver or less brave?
Well, they found some ways around it. And for them, part of that creation was a kind of marronnage. So you had a writer like Félix Maurice Leroy, who he rewrote Antigone in a Haitian setting, so that in Haiti where a mother, you know, these bodies were sometimes at that time left in the street, but nobody could pick them up. So you had this story of this woman who is dying to bury her brother, right, and would risk her life. So they would stage these plays, you know, from the Greeks, from Camus, and from others, and that still gave them. It's like the Haitian songs, you know, like the protest songs, that there's a double meaning to it.
Right, and it comes from the days of slavery where the Marrons were slaves who ran away and hid in the mountains. But marronnage came to mean a kind of double speak and double life, that you could have one face in front of the dictatorship and then another, your real face to your family and friends. And that's what this kind of art was.
Exactly. And the marronnage became immediately part of the art, because the artist, in a way, had to be able to live beyond the moment.
And then it becomes a joke.
Exactly.
And then everybody gets the joke, mm-hmm, except the dictator, because as we all know, dictators are very, very serious people, especially Papa Doc. Well, and Baby Doc.
But eventually, you know, and they did eventually get it. They caught up with a lot of, you know, some of these artists were killed at some point, or some left in exile. But there were these moments when they could create something through, you know, because they were able to use those skills of Maonaj.
It's almost as if the dictator creates a kind of art himself, which is,
exactly.
Maybe we won't go there, but it is, it's a little bit, well, as though the political scene in a place like this, and it's true here too, but we don't realize it because politics is more removed from us. But in Port-au-Prince, where the president is sitting like an angry bullfrog on top of you, you realize his involvement in your day-to-day life. And I think there was a realization that there was interplay between the politicians and the people, the artists and the dictator.
And actually there was this, there were some musicians, for example, that they called, you know, musiciens palais, who were sort of mercenary musicians,
right.
Who they, some of them just performed songs praising the dictatorship too as a way of surviving. And then as soon as you know, the end of the dictatorship, they shifted to protest songs,
right.
So
right.
There was also that sense of there were also these people who sort of went with the flow.
And also the minute one of their songs would come out, a joke song about their songs,
exactly.
Would come out.
Yeah.
One of the main themes of this book is being in a diaspora. Being a Haitian who doesn't live in Haiti, Edwige was 12 when she left Haiti. So it's been not very long, but a little bit of time has passed since she really lived in Haiti. And she writes about the kinds of guilt she feels about using the material that she uses, and the way, it's not just worry that a son will be revealed to have had AIDS, but the whole world of the people that she writes about. She worries that she is some kind of a leech living off that world, and she feels guilt about it. And this is what she says in the book, and I would love to hear about that, because I feel that too, but it's not my family, it's not my people.
Well, I mean, one of the things I want to say that it's not, I'm not like flagging myself through the whole book.
No, and it's not a self-pitying book in any way.
Yeah, and I want it to be as much, you know, a celebration. But I think there are of course are these tensions even within families. In my family, you know, there was my father who left, and then his brother, my uncle, who just never wanted to leave Haiti, and who ironically is buried in Queens, New York after a very tragic situation. But we always had even that, you know, those tensions in the family between those who stayed and those who left. And it wasn't, you know, there wasn't big tensions. I mean, sometimes, for example, before my father was documented, when his sisters died in Haiti and couldn't go, I mean, you felt like that whole
so terrible.
Great, terrible pain of the separations that you see all the time in the place where I live. But I think there's that feeling that if you, in ordinary life, people who are not artists feel, but you still feel the sense that, you know, I'm not going through the same things as everybody. And even, you know, I would, in the beginning, I would tell my, you know, I would say to my mother, you know, it's like, this is your story. I'm writing, you know, it was hard for me to sort of, to claim it. But eventually, I think what I've come to realize too is that there's a story in the space in which I live, in the space where all these places meet. And there's like at least a million of us in that space.
Right.
That it's sort of, it inhabits its own country, which has a mixed gaze of looking at Haiti through the eyes of someone who lives in the United States, looking at the United States of someone who's lived in Haiti. And that's its own, that has its own narratives, that has its own, its
right.
own story.
Immigrant writing, really, which has the advantages of both the outsider and the insider, which of course makes me very jealous. Your guilt makes me jealous. I want that.
Well, you've lived that life of, you know, of Jerusalem. I think you've...
Well, I've lived in many places, but you never feel what an immigrant writer feels, which is that close bond, and yet you're able to turn your gaze back at it. You know, it's really nice. It's like being subject and object at the same time. I wondered if you would tell a little bit about Tante Iliana. This is my favorite part of the book, when Edwige goes back again to a place where she had gone when she was a little girl in Haiti, in the mountains where her elderly aunt lives. And she seems to me to have been elderly even when you were little, yeah. And then again when you come back, even more so. And talk about that and capture, if you can, for the people who have come tonight, how Haiti can seem not just so much farther away than it is, but so much farther away in time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is the interesting thing that I always felt, even growing up in the time that I spent in Haiti, is that there are parts of Haiti that are foreign to even Haitians who live in Haiti, because there's this big dichotomy between, you know, what they call the pays en dehors, the outside country, the provinces, and the city, which, you know, of Port-au-Prince. And so I've always had family in different places. And in the summers, we would always go to the countryside. But my Aunt Iliana lived in a place called Beauséjour, which is my father's ancestral village. And she was the last person in the family to stay there because she didn't want... She thought that once she went off the land, we would lose it. And so she... Once we made the trip when I was younger, because it's a 2-day trip, you know, before, now they have motorcycles and there's a way you can go from Jacmel, but then you had to walk. You walked a day and you spent the night in one town and then you continued walking. And I did it when I was a kid and it seemed easy. But when I was an adult and out of shape, it was just, it's the best hike. I don't know why there's not a bigger hiking business in Haiti.
I know, there should be. There are a lot of hikers.
Yeah, it's just, and so when we get there, you know, of course I come with all my nostalgia and all my, to this, you know, this her little house, and I'm saying to her, you know, I want to be buried here when I die. That's just got to be where I'm going to be buried. And she said, did you not just walk for 2 days? Who's going to carry your body up this And then, and I said...
I love how practical she is.
I know, yeah. And then I said to her, okay, you know, I had a solution. I said, I'm going to be cremated. And immediately she's like, there's enough dust in Haiti. We don't need yours, you know. And where she lives, like when someone dies, also that's also a typical thing of these villages in the mountains. Like there's no, you know, the people you lay there, maybe there's just a day. There's not a morgue, so you're buried either the same day at sunset or you're buried the next morning. And so when she died, which was a very painful thing also for my father, there was no way we would have made it up the mountain for her funeral. So we never, you know, that trip was my, like, that was our goodbye.
She buried in her daughter's mausoleum?
Yeah, she had her, like a lot of people in the countryside, she had her mausoleum in the back of her house. And the mausoleum was where her daughter was buried.
And she built that.
Mm-hmm. And it was, and she wanted it to be, because we had also the family plot, but she's like, I want something just for me and my daughter there. And that's where she wanted to be.
And often the mausoleum is as big as the house.
Exactly.
The
yeah. And sometimes prettier. And,
right.
Yeah.
More splendid.
Yeah.
I don't really see, even ashes, I don't see carrying them that far.
Yeah.
Haitians aren't that into cremation anyway.
No. It's something actually when my uncle, who I mentioned, died, he was 81 years old when he died. He was after something in Haiti. He was detained by immigration. He died in immigration custody, and he had in Port-au-Prince his mausoleum all ready, and he had his suit. He had everything, like, because he thought he would be buried in Haiti. And I tried to convince my family. You know, I was like, we can cremate him and
bring him back, put the suit on him.
Oh no, they're like, no, it wasn't even. They were just like, no. I mean, also he was religious, so they thought that, you know, you have to put the body in the ground, and so, you know, cremation.
There's a lot of ancestor worship in Haiti, so you can't really mess with the body too much.
And also because there's this sort of this, you know, reincarnation, and you need the body,
right.
You
know. Right, you know, you need the body. You talk in a chapter called Daughters of Memory. You talk about something that you describe as your self-created folklore.
My fake lore.
It's fake lore, she says.
Yeah.
And I wondered how, what the fake lore is, and then how folk belief works into your fiction, if you feel it does? And do you, how does voodoo fit into your worldview, and what do you make of it? It's a very powerful factor in Haiti, I know, and I also believe in the diaspora. It's still widespread as a commonality in the culture. What do you make of it all, both as an artist and as just a person?
Well, I think there's some, one of the things that's amazing about voodoo, that even people who don't practice have the worldview. For example, you know, when I was a kid, I remember when, you know, my uncle was a minister, but we had people in the family who practiced. But if we went somewhere to get our hair done, we would just get the hair, because you were, every part of you can't leave it.
Oh, you have to pick up all your hair.
Yeah, and then you know, and just little things that
do you understand that if you leave a part of you, then it can be used against you in some kind of a magic.
But that inhabits part of your spirit, you know.
Right.
So, just little things like that, and sort of, and I remember seeing, you know, before my aunts would cross the river, they would sort of touch it and touch themselves, because there was the spirits in the water, sort of to honor what's there, and all these little things that I think that is very much part of worldview, but also a connection to the spirits, to the ancestors, and that's just part of the stories we tell, and for fiction, you know, the fake lore, you can allow yourself to appropriate it individually, so that, you know, they. It's the same way in dance, in that, you know, they become characters in a way, and you do it respectfully, and you try to do it in a complicated way, but there's a kind of freedom that, you know, like Urzili, the goddess of love, with all her complexity and rage and love and all that, and I sort of like to imagine that from within, and I've had, you know, you do have characters who inhabit these, so you could do a lot with it in fiction, but I, of course, I try to do it as respectfully as I can.
Right. I think we should talk a little bit about the earthquake and how you've experienced it, because I know it's something that everybody here has thought about and certainly noticed and probably sent money for. And how has it been for you in the wake of this? I had a friend who was what I consider to be a New Orleans writer. And she wrote fiction about New Orleans. After Katrina, I wrote to her and I said, it was like a condolence note. I said, I'm so sorry, I can't imagine what it would be like to have, you know, the thing you base all your material on washed away. And then Haiti happened. To me, I feel, but to you even more so as a fiction writer.
But I don't see Haiti ultimately as having crumbled in that sense, that it's free of stories. I mean, one of the very interesting things that happened in the middle of that fiction-wise is that I've been editing this anthology called Haiti Noir. I mean, they have the Los Angeles Noir, and it was a year before the earthquake. And we'd had all these stories, from about 18 writers, 16 of them either from Haiti or in the Haitian diaspora. And after the earthquake, I remember being afraid to look at the stories, because I was afraid they would suddenly be irrelevant.
Right.
And then it was strange to see that it's like they were still wonderful stories. And one of the, I talk about this in the book, in reading Danny Laferrière, the Haitian novelist, who had written a novel about a man who goes back to Haiti after his father dies and is visiting all these places that in some cases no longer exist. And it was a novel about nostalgia and returning, but suddenly felt like a historical novel.
Right.
So then there was like, yeah. So then immediately there was that shift, and you think there will be the Haiti of, you know, after January. But still, and the story, and I was glad I was working on this book, proved that other Haiti is still there. Now, when we did start, and then people started sending us stories about the earthquake, and then the dilemma of fiction when faced with disaster is that there's just no way it could match what the reality is. And I think that takes a while. And that's why, for example, with 9/11, you know, it took so long for people to write 9/11.
People said it was the end of fiction.
Exactly.
Why did they say that? But now, then I felt it with the Haitian earthquake. I began to understand why people would say that, but I think it's really untrue. And I worried for my own book, which is really quite old. I think it was published in 1990, my book about Haiti. And I thought, oh, now it's just a total piece of irrelevance, as I have felt many, many times about this book, by the way. Haitian news kind of goes quickly and dramatically, and you think I've been left in the sands of time. But even with the earthquake, it kind of still makes sense. So I think
it's not, but it's right. It doesn't become, it, if anything, I think it becomes even more relevant because there are a lot of people now who are curious, and it's wonderful for people, I think, for people to see that Haiti is not just the Haiti of the earthquake.
Right.
That it's one of many moments in Haiti. And I think that it's actually, I think it's even, it's refreshing on some level, but it does take, you know, I think for fiction, it's...
It has to boil for a
while. Yeah, it has to, because... When we started getting the very early fiction about the earthquake, it was just like the stuff on CNN. It was just like reproducing things.
Which just cannot match what the earthquake was like.
Exactly.
Even Anderson Cooper on CNN or wherever he is, he could not match the way it was once you were in it.
Yeah, and
even after it happened.
Well, I think that's why you need different voices in a moment like this, because it's, you know, even for one person who lost every, you know, it's hard to tell for anybody to tell all these different stories. And what was great after the earthquake was that we'd had, I think, something we hadn't had before, where people directly in Haiti could tell their stories through the social media.
Amazing.
You know, and you had cases.
Or even the New York Times with that long thing, I don't know if you saw it online, of all the people who were missing. Mm-hmm. It was like the 9/11 thing, but it was for a whole city, and it was really a way in which Haiti had not reached
an
audience.
People
not to be happy about the earthquake, by the way. I don't mean that at all. Didn't mean it.
But also, I think allowing it had people had more of a direct link, and you could see. You know, we saw blogs about people who were talking about losing their children or kids who were talking about losing their school. So there was a kind of, you know, people were able to tell directly their stories. And I think that was, we had not had that before, at least from Haiti, and past disasters.
It was so interesting to me, too, when I went to Haiti, I think it was like 3 weeks after the earthquake, how quickly Haitians, and I think it's a Haitian quality, maybe not, maybe it's anyone in the face of disaster, how quickly they turned all the terrible stories into jokes. Mm-hmm. And long, extended anecdotes with punchlines that were just so wonderful. Yeah. And just faced with the most grotesque misery. It was astonishing.
I think that's part of the spirit. And I think that's what, you know, things like, that's why people like my aunt, you know, with her thing. Like, for example, when I went back, I was amazed how many aftershock jokes that people were saying. It's like, you should have seen so-and-so's face during the aftershock. And there was this couple that we knew where the husband, you know, he left his wife in and he jumped over the balcony and the wife was saying, I knew you never loved me.
Right. Off he goes.
Yeah.
Or I heard one about this, a supermarket collapse killing many, and there was some little old lady is still alive in there, and they found her after like 3 days, and they dig at the rubble around her, and they finally get it open. They say, okay, we're going to get you up. And what do they get up for? Her arms come up, and in her arms is her handbag.
Yeah.
Get that out. Rescue this first.
Yeah, that's the, you know, but for example, I mean, that's the sort of the human quality too, because there were all these stories where they said of people in 9/11 who were jumping off the buildings, clutching their bags, you know, and so I think there's something about, there's some sort of a thing of optimism about the human spirit in Haiti with songs, with these jokes, with people have always, you know, I think that's part of the survival mechanism.
Right, and in Haiti that survival mechanism is really honed to a fine degree because there's been so much to survive. And I think after the earthquake, one of the things, I was almost resentful of it. I was resentful of their ability to get along in the face of something so terrible. I was disturbed. I'm still disturbed by the lack of protest over how they've been treated by the international community. I mean, there's been a lot of sympathy and a lot of money coming in, but still it hasn't been what it needed to be. So, but Haitians will just continue in the face of something so dreadful, making enough out of very little. And it just always surprises me.
Well, that's what, I mean, people talk, so there's so much talk about resilience.
Resilience is the word, yeah.
And part of it, I think it's become a cliche in part because it is so true. But I do worry about this element of resilience that on some level it's come to mean that, oh, you can suffer through anything.
Right, anything can be done to you. You can deal with anything. Yeah. We don't have to really worry.
And so I think...
You're used to it.
Exactly. That's the thing. And people will... So it makes me... And maybe recent events in a way with the outbreak of cholera reminds people of the fragility of the situation.
Right.
Because in part that resilience... I think has sort of diminished in people's eyes the urgency of the situation.
Right. Well, we would love to take some questions from you all if you are interested in talking to Edwige and asking her about what she does and how she does it.
They can also ask you
questions. Oh, you can ask me questions too. Here's a person here. Just wait for the mic.
I really want to know about an island girl. You were 12 when you left Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
I am also an island girl from the island of Bermuda.
Ooh.
And our colonial history is very different from the colonial history of Haiti. In some of the books that I've read, novels that I've read recently, I'm thinking of your Farming of Bones and... The All Souls Rising trilogy, and then recently Isabel Allende wrote a book.
Island Beneath the Sea.
I sense, coming from one of those jewels rising out of the ocean, those islands, we have a different way of looking at the world. And I sense I got from all of that and from your book, Farming of Bones, that there is something different in the nature of the way people view the land and what the land is in Haiti, as though perhaps the blood that had been spilled there had turned the island into sort of a living thing. And I wonder if you'd comment on that, because I don't have that in my island history.
Edwige?
That's a beautiful idea. One of the writers that who's a Haitian woman writer named Kate Lee Mars, who was writing right after the earthquake, she wrote something about the devil dancing, you know, as a way of describing the earthquake. And it was sort of a beautiful, a tragic description as the earth as alive. And I think there's always been that sense about Haiti even before the earthquake, and that sort of there's a story about the island of La Gonâve, which is one of the islands within Haiti. That it's a piece of Africa that drifted and ended up in Haiti, and it's a sleeping whale. And it's said that once the whale awakes, it will give us it will tell us how to have peace. And so there are all these stories about, you know, the living earth and how once we figure that out, we'll figure so many things out, which has a kind of, you know, parallel in, and now when people talk about the reconstruction, they talk about going back to agriculture, you know, and the fact that so many people died in Port-au-Prince because so many people had gone off the land and had moved to the city. And part of the rebuilding, you know, a lot of people believe is going back to the land and having these opportunities so we could have reforestation. And so the earth and all the fake lore and the folklore is seen and did as a living thing, and that, and it's a living thing, and the folklore has grown in that it can get mad at us,
right?
You know?
And there are lots of stories of why the earthquake happened, lots of mm-hmm. interpretations. Can you say the word, the Creole word for the earthquake for the audience?
Gudu-gudu.
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 Supposedly yeah. it sounds like the way the earthquake sounded.
Yeah, and it's funny how one of the first times to see, too, how people would name it, they'll say, you know, bagaila, the thing, événement, you know, the event.
And lots of euphemisms for it.
Yeah, and actually my husband's uncles who was going around with me, he named it Tiwowo, and I said, why? And he said it's because Tiwowo was a kid who used to bully him in school. So he gave it his own name.
There's a certain intimacy there.
Yeah.
Anyone else have a question? Here's one.
Thank you. Do you feel at home living in the U.S.?
Sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. I have to say that the story I was saying about my uncle who died in immigration custody, that's probably the one time I felt the least at home, and that I felt like, I thought I belonged here. And then I had this happen to someone who was very close to me, 15 minutes from where I lived in Miami. So that shook my faith in it. But, you know, I do feel at home in the little section of Miami.
She does live in Miami.
Where I live. I think I have two little kids. And I think when my children were born and I saw their birth certificate, I was like, oh my God, you know, I am, you know, we're all American, really, because I've had kids here, you know, and there. So I think in 100 Years of Solitude, there's a moment where someone says you have not, you know, you don't belong to a place until you have somebody buried in the ground here. And so I have several people buried in the ground now, so I guess I'm at home here.
Anyone else? Yes. Here comes the microphone.
As somebody who struggles to write little tiny things, could you talk a little bit further about guilt and embarrassment? I think as a writer, you know, one of the primary goals is to tell the truth. And in truth-telling, I think we leave ourselves incredibly naked and exposed and vulnerable. So I wonder how you overcome that and deal with it.
And then maybe because you can share too. I feel lucky in the sense that this is totally counter to sort of my personality. But when I'm writing, I feel totally free. Like, and perhaps I think maybe it has also to do with the fact that I'm writing in a language that's not really my first language. So there's a kind of, you know, I feel like a veil in a way. And then I agonize, like when the thing's about to come out, I'm just like agonizing over who's going to be mad.
And you want to hide in a closet?
Yeah,
when it's
exactly.
Publication is the single worst moment in a writer's
yeah,
life.
Yeah, I read about Philip Roth, who went to the newsstand and waits there. Like
excited, wants to read
yeah.
it? No.
And I'm just like, I'm
say
always,
to my husband, you read it, tell me who's going to be mad.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm always like, I wait for that week to be over when the thing is off the stand. I'm like...
Well, you know, it's interesting because in the old days, life was better for writers. Like, you could write an excoriating, violent diatribe against someone, and maybe he'd see it or not if it was published, say, in the New Republic and he lived in Haiti. You know, he might never, ever see it. Now it's like, oh!
Oh, yeah.
Did you see what Amy wrote about you in the New Republic? You know?
Yeah, and no,
it's right there.
Yeah.
You can't hide anymore,
it's
baby.
It's Twitter, it's this, and yeah. it's that. So I think, to your point, there's that sense of being naked is amplified, you know? And so I think, and maybe it makes people a little more cautious, but sometimes surprisingly, but I do think that that core thing hasn't changed, that you are ultimately writing what you think is true, but not, you know, your truth, but it's not all. People won't always when all those agree. And Amy's absolutely right in that immediately now, you know, it's everywhere. And you know, and it's the same about things that people write about you, that even if you're trying to avoid it, you get like six people who forward it to you.
I like to think that I could still write, if she were still alive, I could still write something really mean about your aunt up in Beau Séjour, yeah. And she would not hear about it.
Except, you know how
she might, though, cell phones.
This is how she would, and also then it's like, then there's the radio.
Right. And then someone comes,
yeah,
and tells.
Yeah, and you know, it's still, it seems like just
one
a
world.
a much smaller world now. You know, I mean, sometimes I'll tell you a really, like, one time I wrote this thing about my niece. It was my first niece, and my brother then was not married to his wife, and I wrote the word partner in the thing, and my brother was so angry about the word. I mean, it's like sometimes it's little things, like things that you would never imagine. They would be like, what do you mean I ate too much, you know?
Right.
I mean, and it could be like what you never thought it would be. But I have taken all the precautions in different, you know, like when I wrote the memoir about my father and I had my brothers, you know, I said, you read it first, and I try to do that because, I mean, I wouldn't want to lose family members over that. And even this I think I'm praying that my aunt wouldn't see this, like if she saw it she wouldn't recognize it. But ultimately there would be like, after a while it'd be like, oh yeah, that's her, she does that thing, and you know, say Atisla, you know, you get some flack for being like Atisla, you know, the artist, you know.
I just wanted to say one other thing. Edvige has written about her family. She's written about politics. I've written about Haitian presidents. I've lost a lot of friends writing about Haiti. But never write about Hollywood. It's the most dangerous place to write about, I can tell you. I wrote a book about L.A., and when I wrote about Hollywood, it was an amazing experience for me.
Did you lose friends?
Oh, yeah. I lost friends. I lost waves of friends, yeah. Wow. But I told the truth. Was it worth it about Hollywood? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, do you feel ultimately comforted by that? That you feel like?
Not really, because to tell the truth, to tell the truth about Hollywood, yeah, so, right, okay. But to tell the truth about Haiti, I feel okay with what's happened to some relationships there because that was important. I just hope it was right. See, there I feel, was it right? Because Haiti is so complicated. Whereas Hollywood, it's pretty clear what's going on. more questions? This is a hotbed of questioners.
Edwidge, have you written in Creole, which I presume was your first language? Mm-hmm. And if so, how's the experience differ from writing in English?
Okay, I haven't written directly in Creole, but I've had the experience of translating for Haitian radio. We had a new Jean-Dominique Rousseau, a radio journalist. He had on his radio station was one of the first to do Creole, and at some point they were doing programming. And I had done some of the short stories in Kikak as radio plays for the station. And that was the first experience I had had of doing, like redoing some of the stories in Creole. And the way I write in English, I feel like it's sort of simultaneous translation, that I'm realizing that the people are speaking Creole, but it's coming out in English. And now to have had the experience of translating it back was very interesting. And then actually in one of them, my father was one of the actors in the story, and was saying the lines, which was surreal. And my husband is a translator, and he writes in Creole. He writes children's books in Creole.
One of the interesting things about Creole is that until fairly recently, it was a completely spoken language. And it was a suppressed language, essentially, by the francophone people who ran the country until Aristide, I believe, made it
in 1990,
one the official language, or one of the two official languages of Haiti. So it's not that normal for people to write in Creole, even Haitians, and they usually learn to write in French in school. I remember watching Aristide read a letter written to him who would become the president of Haiti in Creole, and he's like, he goes like this, look, what is this? So I read it to him in Creole. He says, well, how come you can do that better than I can? But it's because it just was simply alien to him to read Creole. That's why.
And it's funny because then he was one of the, you know, he was one of
the advocates.
Yeah, and he also was one of these people who could speak Creole in such a, you know, with that
maronage
and this sort of on so many layers of it. Yeah, but yeah, at the time too that I was growing up, we weren't taught necessarily to write in Creole. But there's some wonderful writers who write in Creole. Frank Etienne is one of them.
Felix pioneered it, really.
Yeah, and he does a lot of great wordplay in it. He's written, actually, he's one of Desafis, one of his novels, is probably the first novel written entirely in Haitian Creole. Felix Maurice Leroy, who's translated, he's written poetry in Creole. So there is, and a lot of the younger writers, primarily poets, now do a lot of writing in Creole.
Other questions over here? The gentleman in the front row there.
Yeah, as an intellectual, after all, when you return to Haiti, are you frustrated by the persistence of a word I haven't heard mentioned yet, voodoo?
You heard it mentioned, you just didn't hear it in its American pronunciation.
Tinnitus. Or how do you treat the persistence of folkways which you feel retard the advancement of Haiti?
I guess I like that.
There's a little contention.
I don't think it retards the advance of Haiti at all. I think it's part of Haitian culture. If anything, voodoo was one of the things that, like the first gathering that inspired the Haitian Revolution. I mean, it's been a strength for the people. It's a cultural strength. It's a political strength. So I would disagree that it's retarding the progress of Haiti.
You know, I think it's... But it's not a totally ill-founded question. And one of the interesting things about it is that there's so much belief outside the country that voodoo, as we say in America, is bad, that it almost, the belief about it outside the country almost makes it bad, in, you know, for Haitians to believe in it. So there's so much prejudice against it. And often when I hear people talk about voodoo in certain ways, I think, well, what they mean is, isn't Haiti, they always want to ask you this question, but nobody will ask it, isn't Haiti really screwed up because it's a black country? You know? And isn't it really screwed up because they've been running it for so long? And what I always say to counter that is, you know, and they love to say it about the Dominican Republic, like, look how good the Dominican Republic, how bad Haiti is. And I say, just remove for a second, even though no one has said the word black or African, I say, just remove for a second race from what you're thinking. And just think about the history. A way early revolution, before anyone in the world was ready for a revolution in a nation like Haiti, a slave nation. Think about slavery. Don't think about race. Think about slavery. And I think when you can, if you can remove the veil of color from over your eyes, then you can begin to see voodoo as a folk religion. And believe me, there are a lot of folk religions in the United States that are practiced today, some of them coming from voodoo and some not, some perfectly white. There's a lot of folk religion in Ireland. I mean, there's folk religion in almost every place. So if you can remove the veil of, you know, 300 years of racism, and I'm certainly not saying this about you, but about a general feeling about voodoo from Americans, then maybe you can begin to see the history as political rather than racial.
Yeah, I'm always struggling to understand why any religion, unless it's sort of state-imposed, would retard the progression of any place. It's like saying fundamentalism retards America, you know?
Oh, don't say that.
Or, I mean, I don't... Well, maybe. Well, sorry. Bad timing. We might yet see that happen, but...
Yeah. But it's a good question to ask, in my opinion. I think it's an important question. Anyone else? Yes, over here. Hi. Thanks.
Thank you.
Wait one sec. We got to get you on the iPodcast.
Welcome. I love every single one of your books. The Dew Breaker is my favorite. Can you talk a bit about your inspiration, who might possibly be mad at you with respect to that book? Also, have you ever thought of your work on screen?
I used to, I missed your first thing, what, inspiration?
The Dew Breaker.
Ah, okay. The Dew Breaker is a collection of stories about a man who's a torturer. I mean, there were many inspirations
the country abounds with inspirations.
Yeah. And there was one particular man, a man named Emmanuel Constant, who at some point moved to Brooklyn, New York. And when I lived there, he was, you know, you would just see him around. Like, he was at the art gallery, he was at church. It didn't have a score, Emmanuel Constant. He was in charge of an organization called FRAP, and you were reporting from Haiti around that time. And he moved to New York. And Karma is a you-know-what. People were always trying to get Emmanuel Constant convicted for crimes against humanity and everything. And he's in jail now, but for mortgage fraud. Of all things.
It's like having Dr. Mengele in prison for mortgage fraud.
Yeah, exactly. So he was part of this whole mortgage thing. But he was one of the... I was always awestruck by this fact that we could be in Brooklyn, New York, in the same room as Emmanuel Constant, like an art exhibit or something, and no one was jumping him or even, you know, cursing him out or anything. And I thought there was this sort of extreme civility that wasn't quite out of fear, but it was just, he was just there, and he was one of many people like that. And then we had one in Florida, a man, well, Karma wasn't so bad in that time, he won the lottery. He won like $3 million, and then that's how people found out that he was actually there. And then there was the victims filed a lawsuit and recently actually got the funds under the Anti-Terrorism Act. So there were a lot of cases like that.
That's a double karma story.
Yeah,
that's a good story.
Yeah, it was like, and then he went, you know, he tried to go, the money was frozen, and then he tried to go back to Haiti with the money and all of that. So there were many inspirations for that. And the second... the big screen, my first job out of graduate school was I worked in a production company, and I know, you know, and I read your book, and I know how hard it is to get things on the big screen. So we've had some things that were optioned, but nothing that's come to fruition.
I think we have time for one more question, and then we are done. There's someone over here. Yes.
This is actually just to go back to the question of Creole and writing in Creole. When I read your work, I think that part of the experience of the immigrant characters that you're writing about, that sort of duality, is, well, one of the ways that it gets manifested is through this code switching, so that in your writing you're using Creole when... I guess there's no other English way to say it, or it's just something internal to the character. So when you translate, say something like Breath, Eyes, Memory into Creole, does that whole meaning change because you're not translating Creole into Creole?
That's very interesting. Like when I was doing the shorter things back in, and even when I have both in the text, to me, it's always an alternate way of saying it. Like I try to make it so that if somebody who's reading it comes across the Creole word, that it's not the first thing they would think of. So I try to just do another way of saying it in English too. So it's got like the double meaning for someone who knows both. And so when I was doing the translating back, it was still an alternate way of saying it. And And it certainly was closer to what people might actually say, but it still was, in a way, it was like another story. And I know there's a writer from Puerto Rico, Rosario Ferrio. She translates her own books, and she said that you get that experience. It's like getting another shot at it or something. You know, it's like you're writing it again, even if the structure and everything is the same. But I don't even sometimes when I don't read the translations myself, because of course I don't, after a while you just, you know, you've had like when you've worked on something for so long and you're just like
never want to see it again.
Yeah. And so but I'm curious sometimes, and I'll look at a paragraph and it becomes its own thing in its own space.
Okay, well, thank you so much for coming this evening. Thanks to Edvige.
Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.